Welcome to After Hours by Red Compass Labs, where the best and brightest of the financial services industry let their hair down, unbutton their collars, and share their passion for payments with Julie and Mike. I'm Mike Truter, an evangelist for digital ecosystems and innovation, and I'm joined by my friend Julie Getter, who has a deep, deep passion for the future of payments. Together with Red Compass Labs, we're on a mission to open the doors of finance to all and protect those who enter. Today, we're going to explore the second part of our mission, protecting those who enter the doors of finance. And we'll be doing so with the help of Chris Caruana, head of the subject matter expert and product strategy team at FeedsEye, a cloud-based risk management platform. As always, like the Scottish knife the skin do, we will try to keep our discussions short, sharp, and to the point. But we can't make any guarantees. So without any script or preparation, let's kick things off. Chris, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Mike.
I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about you and your journey combating financial crime and what brought you to FeedsEye in the first place.
Oh my goodness. First of all, Mike, Julie, thank you very much. And thank you to Red Compass for having me on today. I'm probably an accidental financial crime fighter. And I think if you surveyed a lot of my peers as well, too, you find that we might have stumbled into this realm and decided, hey, we kind of like this. This is important, both from a financial aspect, from a societal aspect. And most of the folks that I've spoken to, from MLROs to BSA officers to chief compliance officers to heads of risk, they enjoy the aspect of what they're doing because of the true nature in which it helps people. Right? And it helps, for lack of better terms, this may sound corny, but it's a better world when we have controls in place to stop financial crime, because the downstream effect of that is huge. So how did I get into this? Yeah, accidentally. I like to tell people that I'm a recovering compliance officer and an anti-money laundering nerd at heart. And it's true, and people laugh about that, but maybe some find that humorous. But I started off in middle office operations at a private bank. And what I didn't know then was the world that I was actually getting into. I was doing some KYC on investment management clients, right? And I said, this is pretty nice. And then finance after university, left, went back to school to get my master's. And when I came back to the U.S. at the height of the financial crisis. And I thought, oh my goodness, jobs are going to be scarce. I got these huge student loan bills. What am I going to do? And I had a friend who was a broker dealer regulator for FINRA here in the U.S. And she said, look, we've got some openings for financial and operational examiners to do health checks on broker dealers. I said, I have no idea about this world, Sally. What am I going to do? She goes, you're a smart guy. You'll figure it out. I'll get you the interview. Go. All right. So next thing I know, I'm a financial and operational examiner for FINRA. And this might scare a lot of your audience listening to this. Man, this guy who knows nothing about broker dealer regulation. But I will give FINRA the credit it deserves. And I still have the coffee mug sitting here on my desk. Is they are a top-notch organization that educates and upskills and brings its staff along. And they couple some newbies like myself with really seasoned industry veterans who know their stuff. They've lived and breathed this. I mean, one of my mentors there was, I think he was in Goldman's back office for about 30 plus years. And this guy knew everything. So they did a really good job of getting me battle ready to go out there and just make sure that, and work with broker dealer firms to make sure that they were protecting their clients and protecting themselves and protecting the ecosystem that gives them so many benefits. And from there, I actually left and went to American Express to work as part of their exam management team. We have it in their enterprise growth division. Enterprise growth, think of it as like an incubator or almost a startup within American Express. Try different ideas, particularly in the payment space. And I actually transitioned into line of business compliance there for enterprise growth. That's really where my AML journey and my financial crime journey started to kick on. And I'd always sort of been part of that space, but it came front and center at American Express. And I credit a lot of my colleagues and my leaders with sort of lighting that fire inside of me that took hold and eventually sort of sent me down this path of financial crime fighting. And then from American Express, I went on to an FX broker, built compliance programs there, built an internal audit program there. The business came calling. It did some strategic initiatives for the business, you know, help improve that bottom line and that revenue number, Mike, that almighty dollar. And then I said, look, I miss this world. So I actually went and wrote a job description of what I wanted to do and how I wanted to get back into the compliance, the regulatory, the financial crime, the payment space. but I wanted to take these business skills that I developed and put those to the test as well too. So I wrote my own job description, literally did this. My wife was very proud of me that I actually went and wrote this all down. And I went searching for this role, and that's when I came across FeedSci. And FeedSci presented a phenomenal opportunity for me to work with the folks who I used to be and help them solve problems that they have, that I know they have, because I had the exact same problems, and I wish I had companies like FeedSci or Red Compass that were there, that were available for me. It was a very limited set of technological tools to help with payments and to help with financial crime fighting and to help with sort of operational risk and controls. It wasn't like that when I was in that space. So coming to FeedSci and having the opportunity to go and help our clients and help out this ecosystem and give them the tools that I wish I had, it was a no-brainer for me.
It's a fantastic story of how you kind of got back to it. I love the concept of you being paired up with somebody with those kind of industry veterans, the people who've been there and seen it and kind of done it. It's so important for people, I think, coming into the industry as well, because you can't learn that stuff off textbooks. It's really experience, I guess, that helps people understand. You know, when you've seen it before, you can do something about it, see it again. That story about FeedSci, you're right. I think the tools are still developing, right? It's still in an early stage. I think you've been there about 2 years now, but it's still a young company and growing incredibly fast, right? Because so much is changing. Do you want to talk a little bit about like those changes on the FeedSci side, what you see happening in the industry as well?
Absolutely. So 2 years, actually 2 years to the day now. Like, this is my 2 year anniversary. So I feel like there's a drink later on today to celebrate in some way, shape, or form. Look, FeedSci, you touched on FeedSci being relatively young in this space, and we are, but we aren't to a certain extent, right? So we've been at this for well over a decade, and we are best in class in fraud, and that's really what we were born out of, right? Which was this idea of a risk engine, give me your data, give me your tire, give me your poor, and I'm gonna go ahead and produce a result for you that identifies risk that you're looking at, right? And we pointed it at fraud, and we've done pretty darn well in that. Now, about 4 years ago, we said, look, what else is there in this space, particularly in the payments and the customer interaction space, right? There's the natural evolution from that in the sort of the financial crime trident of fraud, AML, and InfoSec, cybersecurity was, okay, we're best in class in fraud. What are we going to do? AML, let's go and help our clients with their AML needs. And we started this transition about 4 years ago. I came on 2 years into it as my aforementioned AML nerd tendencies and tried to help FeedSci along its way. And what I've seen within the organization is a tremendous development, particularly in the last 2 years, in getting from a newborn in the AML space to now we're very much pushing the boundaries in the AML space and trying to be that thought leader and that technical leader in how you go about solving for your AML programmatic needs. And it also ties nicely into our sort of latest push and thinking in terms of, you asked me around market expectations and the future direction of what we need to do as a community in the financial crime space to really make an impact. We have this concept called risk ops. And I don't know if you've seen it or heard it, Mike. I know we met up at Money 2020, and it's kind of hard to miss risk ops on our gigantic screen there.
Absolutely.
And if you were to ask me, I mean, we can get into, you could probably ask 10 different heads of risks or MLROs or BSA officers around, okay, what are market trends? What are the problems you're facing? You'd probably get a good three dozen that you can sift through, but you can consolidate those down into five different sort of buckets per se. But really, what do they all sort of amalgamate to? It's this theme of risk ops, and that's why we're heading down this direction. And you might say, okay, what is risk ops? It is an ecosystem revolution. So think about what are, we'll say, the major pain points that we hear from our clients and from the market. Too many point solutions, right? So the solutions that we have, I now have to manage 12 of them just to effectively implement my BAU for my risk and control program. Too many. Like, it's a job in and of itself. You need a whole team just to satisfy those, right? We have customers. I go to my bank. My bank, are they going to treat me as a cluster of people? They're going to treat me as a group. Like, I behave like Julie, and Julie behaves like Mike and like Graham and like Jim, Sarah. And then they're going to cluster us all together and they're going to say, okay, based on that cluster of activity, that's how we're going to treat Chris. No, treat me like me. So when I go to the institution, you should understand my patterns of behavior, how I interact with your institution, how I utilize your products and services. That's just not happening right now. Right. And then the other thing is it not happening because orgs don't want it to happen, or because the way that they're structured and the way that they think about this and the way in which they interact with each other internally is too disparate, right? It's too separated. Because historically, that's just how you did it, right? You had your team for A, you had your team for B, you had your team for C, right?
Divide and conquer.
Yeah, exactly. Now, and part of that was a technical limitation, right? We go back to the tools that we wish we had, or wish I had when I was in some of our clients' positions way back when. I wish I had the communication tools. I wish I had the technical tools for that fraud and AML and operational teams and the front end as well, too. Think about the first line, where they could all talk to each other. They could all work off of the same data sets. They could all utilize the same tools to make the decisions with all of the information that you have at hand within your organization. Right now, I may use data source 157, and my fraud team might use data source 2, 3, and 4. The customer has data across all of those disparate systems internally, but expose those and make those accessible to your teams. Allow your teams to share information. That's really what RiskOps is all about.
I think it's an interesting point, because if you think of how much the tools and the teams are siloed within the bank, this is so much in contrast how like criminals work effectively, because they are a network of people that effectively collaborate very well between themselves. So no wonder why they're always ahead to some extent.
Yeah, they don't have the same restrictions or silos in place between themselves, right?
Yeah, we're not. And I think I think Julie brings up a fantastic point there. And one of the things that we're not stating within the RiskOps framework that you have to do is, okay, you have to destroy all of those team structures and bring them all together into this one giant team, right? That's not what we're saying. It's just the manner and the way in which you work has to change. The way in which we go about and interact with your organization is changing as a customer. So you have to adjust to customer norms, to economic norms, to societal shifts that happen. And how do you go about and do that, right? We talked about the too many point solutions. We talked about treating customers as individuals. We talked about the disparate internal teams, right? So artificial intelligence is this massive sort of word that's thrown out there. What does that actually mean? Humans have to be at the center of that artificial intelligence. So that's to understand the human nature in which you interact with the organization. Another thing is your architecture has to change, right? So the way in which you go about, and we talked about the different data sets that you're working off of. We talk to our firms, think about the way in which you manage and consolidate and distribute your data across your organization and to your third party systems that you're using, like FeedSiphon. And then you have to collaborate. So break down those disparate internal teams, encourage collaboration. What does that really mean? It's having a platform and it's having analytical tools and capabilities to process that data. And process it in a way that it exposes the risk that a fraud team wants to see, and also exposes the risk that an AML team wants to see and that an InfoSec team wants to see, and then allow them all to see that in one place and work together for it. And that's how you root this out. That's how we take that step forward and go from reactive to proactive in the financial crime fight.
I think I have a question for you, actually, and it's coming back to, you know, the bank knowing that it's you and treat me like, you know, as I'm me and not like, you know, a cluster of people or the typical profile of a cluster of people. Actually, like, it's interesting to see, because a lot of people are excluded from the financial services industry exactly for this reason, right? Because we cannot understand their behavior, we cannot cluster them and so on, right? So how are you, like, you know, guys planning to disrupt this?
Truly great question, which is, and it's almost like we did rehearse this. I know Mike said this is unrehearsed, right? But and I love unrehearsed conversations, but you teed that up very nicely for me, because at the center of this is identifying who your customer is, right? The cluster gets you there, but it doesn't get you there, right? I now become one of 100 instead of one of one. So identity matters. So knowing who that individual is, so forming the baseline of them from a KYC perspective is truly important. But also identity means behavior. So one of the things we do at FeedSci is we have behavioral biometric capability in which I, if you've deployed our behavioral biometric capability, you can understand as an organization how Chris Caruana behaves when they interact with the organization. So you know how I log in, you know how I move across the screen, whether it's on mobile or on desktop, you know how I execute a payment, you know how quickly or how not quickly in my case, I fill in my information when I go to make a payment. And so you have now established my identity, not just by knowing who I am and going through and gathering my demographic information or screening my name against some sort of watch list to understand if I'm an at-risk person or a sanctioned individual, but you now know me by me. You now know me just by the nature of me interacting with your organization. So that if, Julie, you were to go and hack into my account or my account were to be subject to some sort of malicious activity and I start to act erratically or different than the baseline of behavior that you have established for me, you know that. Right. So, and you don't even need me to tell you that, hey, that's not me behaving that way. You just naturally know that I've deviated way too far away from my behavior. Now, if I was in a cluster and you were performing or were deploying some of those clustering techniques, that behavior may deviate from me significantly, but it may not deviate too much or too significantly from the cluster that you wouldn't catch that. Right. And this is what we mean by treating customers as individuals. And also establishing an identity baseline of that individual, not just your normal KYC procedures, but also understanding the behavior and how a customer interacts with your organization.
I think this is super interesting because if you think of, again, what we're trying to do at Compass Labs, right, then detect sign of modern slavery within transaction, actually we could do that with behavior because usually you have effectively, like, you know, different behavior from different people living under the same name or the same address or this type of thing, right? So you could actually detect easier sign of modern slavery through that and behavior being different.
Yeah, couple, think about Red Compass Labs and all the data that you guys have, right? So, and it's not just about having it too, but it's how it's deployed and utilized within your system. So yeah, absolutely. It's a good time to be a financial crime fighter. It's a tough time though. It's a thankless job, but it's a good time.
Yeah, actually, let's roll back. You mentioned we chatted at Money 2020 in Amsterdam. One of the phrases I remember you mentioning there when we spoke about like using the same data or sharing data was that, you know, banks tend to have a bit of an allergic reaction when you mention data sharing, right? Because there's so many rules internally to protect data, to segregate data, to not allow different groups to have access to that, But you know, fundamentally, we need to find a way around that if we're to leverage the data and actually make sure that we keep our customers safe and, you know, keep the industry safe as well, because, you know, that we need to maintain trust. But how do we get around that allergic reaction? Because that must be the toughest challenge of all.
I have my opinion, but I'd also love to hear some of your thoughts about this, because I think because we were off mic, we went a little deep with some of our opinions. Mike, we're back on mic, but I won't pull any punches here, which is simply ask the question. It's amazing to me how many conversations I have where the response is, oh, I don't have access to certain servers or certain data sets within my organization. And my immediate response to that is why. And the natural inclination, that allergic reaction has always been, well, it's either PII or it's on a server or a data set that isn't privy to our function or our group, or we just haven't taken the time to go and actually map to that data source. So within our tech resources, the priority just isn't there to do something like that, right? There's always an excuse, and excuse is probably a bad word. I think the word is there's always been this sort of historical norm that I feel like if we poke that collectively, and I encourage our clients and our prospects to just ask the questions internally to better understand why, I think we just accept it. And we even do it at FeedsEye internally sometimes. We just accept things have always been that way and that's how they're going to be, instead of sort of scratching at it and saying, well, why is it like that? Why can't I access those data sets? Why can't they be utilized? They can't be utilized to fight financial crime, but they can be utilized to generate revenue. It still perplexes me to a certain extent on why those questions aren't being asked and why we're not scratching at this more as a collective group. I think the easy default answer there is, well, the regulator said no, or there's legal liabilities to that, right? And then you get to talking about, okay, encryption of that data. If we can just encrypt it and then we can share it, right? I think we're going too far down that path. We should ask the basic questions on, and you should ask them of your regulator. You should also ask them internally of your counsel. Why can't this information be shared? And if there's a manner in which they're comfortable with you sharing it internally or accessing it, tease that out as part of those conversations and then try to work on a creative solution to actually do that. By no means am I saying, look, share data that you shouldn't be sharing. What I'm saying is I think we just take these things for granted instead of asking the questions, because there are ways out there in which you can access that. You can utilize that. We just have to have the conviction to do it.
I completely agree. And I think your point is extremely valid. It's, you know, just because it's a hard problem to solve doesn't mean it's unsolvable. And we should be spending time to find ways to do it, right? If we know it's the right thing to do, then there's a case, and that case, you know, has a solution. You know, we're smart people. That we can find a way if we choose to invest the time and effort to find a way through. And I really liked your comment there about, we can use it when revenue's there, but not when it's financial crime. It should be the other way around. You know, first and foremost, we should use it to kind of protect. And secondly, to earn revenue, although I know there's a balance there. You know, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, Mike, allow me to share an anecdote from my time at American Express. The business was having their sort of sales kickoff for, I can't recall if it was for the beginning of the year or maybe it was like one of our quarterly reviews, but compliance is invited into those conversations naturally, so kudos to the team there. And I sat through presentation after presentation of we made X money, and there were people writing all of these figures on the board, or they had them up on slides. And then it came time for me to speak. And, you know, the compliance kind of towards the end of the conversation, or maybe right after lunch, right? Everyone's still settling in. And I purposely didn't create any content for that. And I walk up to the whiteboard and I just draw a giant zero on the whiteboard. And I capped the marker, I put it down, and I went and sat in my seat. And the GM of the division was like, Chris, do you want to tell us anything? And I was just waiting for a response. And I said, yes, that zero on there represents the amount of money that we got fined last year for inappropriate compliance program controls. I said, and I walked right back up to the board and I wrote a number up there. And I don't recall the exact number right now. It might've been somewhere in the 20 billion. I said, that's the amount that the industry got fined. I go, so we made $20 billion for American Express last year. And I sat down in my chair, and it was a bit cheeky, right? But I wanted to make a point, which was especially, and I do think that there's a tide changing here, particularly in the boardroom around the optics of your risk and control programs and your financial crime programs. There's definitely a culture shift that needs to be more. But it's always been viewed as a cost center, right? I'm dumping cost into this. But what am I saving? What am I getting out of this? And I do think that particularly in this risk ops journey, you can find a way in which you can start to utilize your financial crime teams as business drivers as well, too. When you get comfortable, when you have a level of confidence that you are not leaky within your AML program or within your fraud program, right? When you have that level of confidence in the tools that you're using and then the people and their ability to use those tools effectively, you can start to gradually take more risk within your business because you can sleep well at night knowing that, look, I've got the best technology, the best teams, the smartest people working on this. That enables you to do more with your business. And we are seeing a mentality shift there. It's a slow burn, though.
I'm not really surprised, you know, like, I mean, at the end of the day, you ask the most risk-averse people within the company to actually take a risk, right? So, of course, you're not going to take this risk. And interestingly enough, like recently around data sharing, I heard that the word share is pushing all basically risk up operators, like, you know, like people working in sanction for AML, KYC, and so on buttons. And instead of saying sharing, you should say collaborate. So I start, you know, like sort of experimenting it and say, oh, perhaps like, you know, we should collaborate on data and so on. And it's interesting to see actually the reaction of people is different. you know, when you use the word collaborate as opposed to share. So sometimes a change in semantic can help a bit.
Words mean something, Julie, right? They have meaning. It seems to fly in the face of when we were kids and we did the sticks and stones, right? Sort of made very good bones, but words will never hurt me. But, you know, words mean something here. So the way in which you use those and the way in which you talk to those risk-averse folks internally do mean something. And we tease that out as part of our client discussions as well, too.
Yeah, it's part of the story that we have to tell, I guess, and people have to understand the benefit it brings. And you know, I think your American Express story was exactly that. Actually, you can't run a business unless it's a safe business, and you can't, you know, grow society unless society's safe. Mm-hmm. You know, so those things go hand in hand. But sometimes, yeah, they don't equal revenue, but they equal the ability to earn revenue in the first place.
Well said. Well said, Mike.
I think it's interesting because, like, if you think of where we are heading to, right? We're heading to actually a different shift of short of the models that we know today. So one with blockchain and perhaps in the future with quantum as well, right? So for me, it's interesting because I feel like we are just at the tiny beginning of trying to master this ecosystem, and we're going to shift to a completely different paradigm very soon. So I'm keen to hear your opinion on this, actually.
Oh my God, Julie, you've just as you teed me up nicely before, you've teed me up in a tough spot right here, because we've talked about this before, and I'll to a certain extent, I feel that we use this term cryptocurrency, and it gets mashed together with a bunch of other things. And one of the things that I tease out internally, like there's cryptocurrency, and then there's blockchain, right? And there's you could probably throw a bunch of other buzzwords or acronyms in there. The technology underlying all of this, I do believe that it has transformative properties. Where I think the industry does itself a disservice is it has sped along and saying this is going to change the world in such a quick, short manner. We come back to that comment, Mike, around allergic reactions to things. Folks don't understand this space. Some of the folks in this space don't understand this space. Right. So when you tell the entire world that it's going to change, this is going to change their world, and then you don't tell them how it's going to do it in a way that's easily understood by the masses, you have created this pain for yourself. So I've been blessed that probably over the last 18 months, as part of my job, I've dug into this space, and I think I know about 4% of it. Right. But I don't know what I don't know about this. And when I speak to firms in this space and we talk about, okay, what could we maybe do together? And I try to understand this better. I realize that they're still feeling their way through the dark a decent amount with this. But in an effort to drive a business forward and in an effort to create this buzz and create this whole new market and telling people that we're going to change the world and also in a race for funding, we've created this problem, in my opinion. We've created a pretty big divide in people who are vehemently against this or feel that, and I think I've used the word Ponzi scheme before in conversation. There are folks that generally feel this way, and whether that's true or that's not, that's how they feel. And I think part of it is a lack of education and simplification for the masses to adopt this, right? So think about the iPhone when it first came out. Steve Jobs went up on stage and he said, I'm going to give you a phone. I'm going to give you a calendar. I'm going to give you Notepad, I'm going to give you email, and I'm going to give you all in one device, right? And this literally changed the world, but he didn't get up there and say, I'm going to change the world. He get up there and said, this is what this is, and this is why you need it. And we all instantly reacted with, yeah, we do need that. And it was so simple. I could hand an iPhone to my young daughter, and in 20 minutes, she'll figure out how to use that. Probably better than my parents. You need to simplify things and you need to educate them. And I think blockchain has suffered a little bit from that. And a lot of the stuff that's propping it up right now, particularly around cryptocurrency and as a means of, or as a medium of exchange, is the volatility around that. You still get FOMO. So it's driving people to say, hey, I want to make that quick dollar. Regulators don't know how to handle it. Then they try and overregulate it. The institutions start to say, look, this is how it has to be done. This is how you have to think about it. It's a bit of a mess right now, in my opinion. And I think if we bring it back down to basics for folks to understand, and you invite people in and help them understand why this may change the world, and you explain to them the underlying technology and what it actually means, I think you're going to get an accelerated adoption schedule instead of just going out there and telling people on LinkedIn or Twitter that you have to do this and not explaining why.
Great point.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I totally resonate with your point around one, lots of buzzword will be mixed up, right? Crypto is completely different as blockchain, is completely different as CBDC, and so on, right? And people think it's a one bucket of the same thing, which is absolutely not. So I think for me, that's the issue. And then the second issue is around what is making the most noise, right? And this is probably crypto today and NFTs even more, I would say. And I told this story to Mike, right? I tried to buy an NFTs, let alone that I'm actually an American citizen living abroad. So finding a means to do this was already a challenge. And then the process to get an NFT is so complicated. I don't know how, everyone can basically do that. Yeah, probably for our children, it would be easier because they are digitally native and so on, but our grandparents, this is a completely different story, and I feel they'll be left out. So effectively, we just introduce a new way of transacting with the idea of being more inclusive and the creation of DAO and this type of concept. But effectively, it's more exclusive than ever. And I think we are leaving even more people out than what we have in the traditional system.
Julie, that last point is spot on. The word inclusive is constantly used, but it's excluding a ton of folks if you aren't inviting them in and explaining to them why that's important. I also think that this is a new world. Let's pull this back into the context of Red Compass Labs and FeedSci, right? New data sources, new ways to capture and codify data, right? And then when you want to feed it through a risk engine like FeedSci, you have to then teach that technology and that risk engine how to interpret that data, this new sort of data field. And you have to create new data schema mappings that have to feed these new data sources and these new ways of going about and identifying risk, right? You have to sort of retrain your technology to a certain extent, right? It's not just as simple as, not just a new medium of exchange, it's another type of currency, right? There's the nature of the cryptocurrency means that it's a completely new data set and data source. And then you need to then retrain some of your technology to go ahead and interpret that and interrogate that for risk and control purposes. So there's a whole, that's a whole other session, right? That's
I agree. And I think to your point as well around retraining retraining the machine, it's interesting because if you think of, how today an AML system or KYC system will know me, right, in this current paradigm is very different from actually a system should know me within a blockchain. I'm not known under my name. I'm known under the combination of
I'm going to disagree with you, Julie.
Please go ahead.
I actually think maybe we're focusing too much on cryptocurrencies where people are not known and where there's a lack of transparency. And what I'd like to think is that actually that's one of the things that makes it difficult is because people are trying to potentially hide things through that. Actually, we need to get back to, not just the inclusivity you guys spoke about, but the transparency as well of the transaction, because that's what's really mattering here. The reason why it's hard and it's difficult is because actually it's not standardized, it's not open, it's not transparent, and it's not clear who the beneficiary is and who's sending the money and so on. And we need to find a way to get that out of the system as well and bring it back to something that is, again, safe and secure, because we need to protect people in our financial services industry. I know we didn't really want to get into this topic too far, but actually, I think a lot of our role is to protect society, and we need to do that, in a way that's responsible, which also means within certain regulation or within certain norms that are acceptable to society. And that's critical. And, it's why I think that, we're going to see a lot of regulation helping to create that transparency, helping to make sure there is inclusivity, that all people who use it are protected in our society as well. And that basically criminals can't prosper, you know, which is the bottom line, right? That's why we protect those who enter. It's a complex topic, and I understand there's all sorts. Chris, you've got the Declaration of Independence, I think, behind you, right? Looking at that, which kind of, you know, gives people freedoms, certain freedoms that they can enjoy as individuals, but it has to be balanced as well. You know, we have to treat all men as equal, right? And somehow that balance comes in. I think it's a complex topic, probably way deeper than we want to go into today.
Let's pull it out a little bit, Mike, and let's come back to my point earlier within our risk ops studio at FeedsEye around collaborative analytics. The economy is giving all of us a new method of payment, a new method of interacting, right? So now we've gone beyond, are our fraud teams talking with our AML teams? It's, are you looking at Mike's activity, both on the chain and off the chain, in a holistic fashion, in totality, right? Historically, right now, and these, a lot of the conversations that I'm having with financial institutions, like, do you do anything in the crypto space? I said, that is a fantastically broad question, right? Like, first, what do you mean by crypto, right? We'll start there. But in reality, if I can go pay for my groceries and they're like cash, credit, or crypto, and that all that information feeds through to my bank or through my car payment, how are teams looking at that information? Are they looking at my crypto payments separately and as a standalone, and then my fiat payments separately and as a standalone? When do those two meet? What sort of tools are you using that allow you to actually look at all of that from start to finish? So you can sit there and say, look, yeah, we service the cryptocurrency industry, or we service digital wallets, or we service crypto exchanges, right? But if you're not sitting there and looking at that activity in a unified fashion, you're missing a trick in order to protect both your institution, those individuals, and really truly understand the risks that are posed to your organization. Right? So as part of that risk assessment, before you even get that far down the road, these need to be reconsidered, right? So I actually think, coming all the way back to before you even deploy technology, risk assessment frameworks are changing. So you have to account for these, right? And then you have to account for covering those off in a unified and collaborative fashion.
Well said. So, Chris, simple question. If you could snap your fingers and change one thing that would make the biggest difference, what single thing would that be?
I'd love to see my AS Roma soccer team actually win the Scudetto, win the Italian championship this year. That would be fantastic. Fantastic, Mike. But I assume that you're asking about this in the financial crime context. If I can change one thing, what would it be? You caught me off guard with this, Mike, because I wish you would give me three things. One of the things
you can
is,
have three.
I can have three. Okay, yeah. I want smarter regulation, not more regulation. And if smarter means less, I'd love that. Like I hear folks say, we need more regulation. No, we don't. We need smarter regulation. Two, give the industry a break, so to speak. The majority of activity that they have to look at and they have to process, it's completely legit. It's fine. Allow them to experiment more. Allow them to take, we'll say, more risk with technology, with regulators and with law enforcement close at their side, and see what sort of results you get. So yeah, smarter regulation. Give the industry a break a little bit. Be tougher on those that are blatantly flaunting this, right? Like I've seen in budgets, regulatory fines, right? Like not a good sign. I understand that you have the financial plan and inevitably some of these firms are so big that, and you're trying your hardest. And then I would say the other thing is hug your compliance officer, hug your risk officer. It is a thankless job. It really is. What I'd like to see is I'd like to see them get more of the, if I snap my fingers, I'd like to see them get more of the appreciation and the recognition that they deserve. Because they do this because they love it. They're not getting paid like superstar athletes, and they're performing extremely important tasks. So thank them every now and then.
Lovely. Okay, last question for you. Crystal ball time. So where are we headed? What's exciting you about the future, the things that you see on the horizon?
What excites me is the cultural shift that I feel, and folks may say, hey, I've been hearing about that for a decade, but this is a slow burn. The desire to want to embrace controls and the technology that, or the, should say, to embrace the technology in order to have more effective controls in your organization that then go and enable your business. I think more people are waking up to the fact that compliance doesn't have to be a cost center. It can be a business enabler. And I think more people are waking up to the fact that this is absolutely, it's not just a must do, but it's an opportunity for firms. It's an opportunity for them to leapfrog some of their competitors and sort of set the tone for the rest of the market. One of the things that makes me a little scared about the future, Mike, even though you didn't ask, I'm going to tell you anyway, sorry, is the way in which we talk about some emerging technologies and them being, we'll say, game-changing or a must-have for society, or we have to do this without even having the debate around whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Like we leap forward with, we have to do this. And I think almost some of the tension around political discourse has sort of fed into economical discourse around having open and honest conversations around what these actually mean. And they have implications on financial crime. I think topics like ESG and CBDCs and things like that. CBDCs. I sometimes mix that up. I think we have to have more open and honest conversations about what these mean and why we're going down this path. They're not happening. We've just leapfrogged to, we need to do this. And the implications are vast, not just on financial crime programs, but on society in general and how we interact with each other.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Chris, so much to talk about and so little time. Unfortunately, I think we need to bring today's discussion to a close at that point. But thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your thoughts and insights, inspiring us and inspiring the industry as well as we work towards a shared common goal to protect those entering the doors of finance and making sure we protect everyone. The future's exciting. There's a lot of good stuff in there, but I think your point about, you know, there's a little bit of scariness as well. I guess that'll keep us on our toes, but it means that there's a good fight to fight. And I'm glad to have colleagues like you in the industry that we can fight that battle with for the good of the greater society.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Julie, for putting up with me.
That's all for this time. Catch you on the flip side.
At Red Compass Labs, we exist to help open the doors of finance to all and to protect those who enter. I hope today's discussion sheds some light for you on the fascinating future of payments that is unfolding all around us. We really appreciate the support of our audience, so if you've enjoyed this discussion, please show your support by giving us a thumbs up, hitting subscribe, and clicking on the bell to get notified when new content arrives in future. Also, don't be shy about giving us feedback. We really appreciate your comments and suggestions for topics and guests. That's all for this time. Catch you on the flip side.